This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When David Bowie was transforming himself into his androgynous alter ego, Ziggy Stardust, Mick Rock was there to photograph him, helping to turn Bowie and Ziggy into icons. Rock became Bowie's official photographer and became an important part of England's glam rock scene. Then he moved to New York in 1977 in time to photograph the punk and new wave scenes. His photos are on the album covers of Lou Reed's Transformer and Coney Island Baby, Iggy and the Stooges' Raw Power, Queen's Queen II and Sheer Heart Attack, The Ramones' End of the Century, and Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll. More recently, his subjects have included Michael Stipe and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Rock's new book collects his photos of Blondie and its lead singer, Deborah Harry. It's called Picture This. On the cover is a photo of Deborah Harry that was first published on the cover of Penthouse.
They put it on the cover of Penthouse, clothed in black to her neck, which Debbie and I thought was very entertaining, in fact.
In addition to being clothed in black, she has a scarf around her neck.
So yes. There's a minimum amount of skin.
Which is very unusual for the cover of Penthouse. But what's happening on her face that makes this so erotic?
Ah, yes. Well, it's the face and the hands, of course, the shoulders. The whole body language is so highly charged. An interesting thing about Debbie, of course, is I don't think there's any pictures of there lurking about out there of her without any clothes on. I mean, I suppose when she was a bit younger, she was a Playboy bunny at the Playboy Club. But I don't think anybody's ever seen Debbie's naked breasts, unlike a lot of modern performers. So notwithstanding the fact that she's regarded probably as the sexiest lady that ever came out of rock and roll, she has done it all pretty fully clothed. I mean, short skirts in her youth, obviously, but that was about as saucy as she actually got. But the face, of course, is an unbelievable face.
Now, in your Deborah Harry book, you write, "I responded strongly to Debbie's libidinal pull. I knew that this was someone I could do some magic with photographically." What about David Bowie? Did you respond to his libidinal pull? And what did you relate to? What did you relate to about his makeup and gender
blurring?
Well,
his androgynous thing. Well, you have to understand the spirit of the times, of course. This was abroad, the whole gay liberation. I had many gay and bisexual friends, and so I was, if you like, already inculcated into a certain sensibility. Because for me, these were people who were like outlaws. These were people who were exploring interesting terms, interesting realms aesthetically. So the androgynous thing was something that was part of the times, of which David was certainly the finest exemplar. So, but of course, that also embraced my dear friend Freddie Mercury and also Lou Reed and certain other characters of that time. Look at early Roxy Music.
When you were photographing David Bowie in his Ziggy Stardust years, were there things you tried to do with lighting or with camera angles that you thought helped to bring out both his female and male sides?
I think it was less to do with that than to do with the nature of my understanding of him. I did some pictures in April of 72. There are ones in the pink room which are quite well known. They're actually taken in his son's room at that time, his son's bedroom. And there's some pictures of him. There's a famous one of him in the mirror. And it all looks in a way kind of has a little Pre-Raphaelite touch to it. And he said, when he viewed that session, he said to his manager, and his manager, I remember coming out of a meeting and repeating it to me, he said, Mick sees me. In fact, he's the first photographer to see me the way I see myself. So clearly there was a sensibility link between the two of us that was very strong from the beginning. So quite how it happened is hard to say. It's one of those interesting alchemical things, you know. It's this kind of like a plasma that oozes off the subject onto the film. But I think he has used, here in interviews I've seen him say, that Mick was very empathetic. So I think maybe that was key to what happened. He was able to allow himself to explore the androgynous thing. I think it was less in those early days about the lighting and the angles so much as the meeting of our sensibilities.
Did you help him create the Ziggy Stardust persona?
No. David Bowie created the Ziggy Stardust persona. I was an interpreter. I helped him get it over. I took a bunch of key images at a key time that helped transmit, that helped interpret that image. But absolutely not. Nobody created Ziggy Stardust but David Bowie.
Do you have a favorite photo of him that you took?
It's hard to say. There is a famous shot of him, which is actually a performance shot of him biting Mick Ronson's guitar. I mean, as over an 18-month period, there are quite a few of them, but there's a particular black and white one of the first time he did it that was reproduced in an English full page in an English rock newspaper called Melody Maker that definitely helped get David over. It was like seeing Jimi Hendrix biting his guitar or setting it on fire or Pete Townsend smashing his guitar. It was one of those classic rock and roll moments, and of course it fulfilled the sense of androgyny that was in the air, because there was David Bowie apparently on his knees gnawing away on Mick Ronson's guitar. So it had a moment. It was like it's hard to imagine that anyone would be shocked by that today, but in those days that was kind of shocking.
You photographed the Ramones, and you're right, when you first saw the Ramones,
yeah,
you thought they were very short on rock and roll sexual allure, which you considered a distinct drawback. You say they struck you as the least attractive band you had ever witnessed to that point.
Yes.
So,
well, I think that remained true. However, as time went on, I grew to love the music. I don't know that the way they look I ever found sexually alluring, and probably nobody did. Their strength really was their music. And of course, they did have a distinctive look. They exemplified, if you like, American punk, which was not as fashionably sharp as English punk, as manifested by the Pistols or the Clash. But
no, the Ramones were just like t-shirts, jeans, and scraggly hair.
Torn jeans,
of course.
Yeah. Yes,
you
had to be
leather
torn
jackets,
around the knee.
Leather jackets, yeah.
Yes, and Converse. But the music, you know, you have to give them the music. The music
absolutely.
So, and remains, sounds so fresh to this day. So, but when I first saw them, it was a bit like I'd been used to photographing very beautiful men, very androgynous men, and there were these four who were not, you know. I mean, the gayest person in the world wouldn't have gone home with any of them, probably. Maybe Dee Dee, you know? But that would have been about it.
And you never suggested that Dee Dee or Joey put on eye makeup or anything, too?
No, Dee Dee might have gone there. There's some interesting stories about Dee Dee out there, having been actually a bit of a male hustler in his youth. But that's a whole other tale. And not for me to tell.
Okay. Now, in your Blood and Glitter book, which was your glam rock collection of photos, David Bowie wrote the introduction. And I want to quote something he says in the introduction. I love this. He says, glam rock never made an impact on middle America to any extent. We were bookended by Alice and Kiss, butch manly glam with lots of guillotines and fireworks, muscle and metal. No mistaking the sexual bent of those fellas. Nothing ambiguous about our boys. That's the only way Ohio could accept lipstick on males. Do you agree with that perception?
I think so. I think David's very astute. The interesting with David is he can be inside and outside something at the same time. I would say absolutely. I mean, Gene Simmons with all the makeup on, I don't think anybody ever thought he was androgynous. And even Alice. And believe you me, I remember going with David in 72 at the high, just as Ziggy was taking off, and Alice Cooper was the biggest band in the world. And it was the... I remember him singing Dead Babies. What was it? The Killer album. It was great show, great theatrics, but not even though, yeah, they're wearing makeup, I mean, I don't think anybody thought of them. I think it was theatre rock. It was clearly a very theatrical thing. It would be like, it's like Marilyn Manson, although I do believe he's a brilliant man, Marilyn. I don't think his androgyny is in a certain way closer to Alice's than it ever was to David, because David was, let's face it, and remains to this day, a very beautiful man by any standards. But there was, in those days, let me let you into a little secret, is that the truth of it was, in those days, is that boys that looked like girls got the hippest girls, and that was a fact. So don't think that this was a lot of poovery going on, although there was a certain amount. Believe you me, there was a lot of rabid heterosexual acts going on at that time, and the boys in makeup, and that would have included myself at times, although not as overt as some of my friends, were not left by the wayside when it came to hanging with the ladies. Let me let you in on a little secret.
No, but getting back to what you were saying, let's keep this to England, where you were at the time.
Yes.
Why do you think?
Although
that...
I did tour America with David, and I did tour America with Lou Reed in that period too. So
why do you think that men in makeup were so appealing to women?
I think it was an outgrowth of the hippie thing. Again, remember everything, because the softening of the male. I mean, boys were growing their hair long. Now, today, a boy with long hair doesn't necessarily look effeminate or female. But I remember when my hair was starting to creep down below my ears, I would get wolf whistled all the time. So, you know, one got called puffs, or one got give us a kiss, all that stuff was going just on the basis of long hair, and not even hair that was that long. So one has to remember the times. And so that soft boy look had already been established as being heterosexually appealing. It wasn't. Then there was a bit of makeup, and then, you know, the clothes started getting a bit fancy, and then it was. And you also, the glam thing in England was also, if you like, known as decadent rock. The idea of all these boys looking like girls, and it was a very sexual period. It was very highly charged. It was a lot of makeup, a lot of dress up, and a lot of heterosexual sex going on. Of course, it was also the time of the emerging gay revolution. And so all these things were all tangled up together, all at the same time. And I was living the moment.
I imagine there were a lot of secrets you had to keep during that time. I mean, for instance, Freddie Mercury's Queen came out years later, but, you know...
People
in the circle probably knew, but I don't think they necessarily wanted record buyers to know it.
Oh, I don't know. I understand what you're saying, and maybe that is true of America, and let me not... I mean, I was touring in America, but I wasn't living here at that time. So, but Queen were called Queen. I mean, it was pretty clear that Freddie... was bisexual.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear that Freddie was bisexual. And when they came to me, they wanted pictures where they looked like girls. And I, frankly, though the earliest pictures I shot of them, they looked like a bunch of very kissable schoolgirls, to be quite frank. So all of them, notwithstanding the fact that the other three are absolutely not gay at all. But Freddie was living with a lady. In fact, the lady who eventually he left his entire estate to, a lady called Mary, who remains a friend of mine to this day. And he was living with her when I first met him, but you've got to remember also the power of the amongst the young, and it's probably true today, but of course I'm not quite as young as I once was, but the being hip. So if androgyny was the hip moment, you wanted to be androgynous. And if the idea that you may or may not be bisexual was floating around, well, that was all good for pulling the girls anyway. So it's, there's pictures of me and David out there somewhere. We would look like a couple of schoolgirls as well. So, you know, I admit that I was working that turf as not just in my subject matters, but also in the way I was presenting myself, but not as extreme as a David. David was a very special and a very theatrical case. David was steeped in theatre, remember, from an early age.
What kind of makeup did you like to wear?
Well, I used to always wear a little coal under my eyes. But I was known at parties. There would be you get a little coal, you get a little rouge, and a little lip gloss. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't overly powdered, but like some people I knew. But definitely, I always wore coal, and I if it was a party, I would be quite happy to slap it. I would have a little thing of lip gloss in my bag. You know, and of course I was married already. I was already married by about the age of, 21. So it wasn't clear. But no one quite knew. It was all so mixed. And it was also a time of great exploration. The whole sexual thing had popped way out of the closet thanks to the hippies. And this was a time, if you like, of consolidating all of that. And you've got to remember, this is also, you know, a pre-AIDS period. So I write in my introduction to the book, you know, everybody kissed everybody, held hands with everybody, and went home with everybody. And therein lies a truth, that there was a huge amount of sexual experimentation amongst a core constituency, mm-hmm, of the hip community at that moment in time. In fact, to indulge yourself sexually, and let's face it, we were young, we were not so sophisticated as we thought we were, was in and of itself a statement, a revolutionary statement, if you like. So the fact that it's different now, it's very, when you look back, one tends to look from the perspective of today. But if you lived in that moment, it was very exciting. There we were, upsetting people, and we were definitely in the upsetting. You know, we're still trying to upset our parents. You know, we're still distinguishing ourselves from an earlier generation. Today, it's very different. It's not the same at all. You know, it's very hard to view it in the same way.
You write that you stopped taking drugs and stopped smoking after having bypass surgery in 1996.
Stimulants, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Did you ever try to do that before bypass? Like, did it take bypass to kind of force you to stop?
Uh-huh. Yes. To be candid, yes. It was God's way of straightening my arse out. I think there's no... And, of course, the beauty of it is that creativity was something that I didn't have a problem with, but getting my life together, I did. However, it cleared me out. It was like when they cut me open, all the demons flew out. And after that, I became much more clear-headed. And I finally learned how to change gears so that life... Before that, I think for me, the excitement that I got out of taking pictures, out of being around music, I wanted that to go on all the time. And whatever I was doing was an attempt to constantly maintain that excitement. What I learned after... as a result of a very painful experience, because, yes, I had bypass surgery, and some people, of course, recover quite quickly because it is... But me, I was also detoxing. So it was very painful, but I didn't... I actually handled it very, if you like, very well. I kind of knew at the time that this was the end game. I knew that this was it. But what it did was it allowed me, in a sense, to rebirth. And that's what has happened. Now, I can go into the head now. I can go to places where I used to go with a little chemical help without that help nowadays. But, of course, I do a lot of yoga and massage and preparation. And I can go in. A little coffee helps, I will admit. So coffee or a Red Bull. So it's not that I'm entirely, if you like, clean. Although when I do, it's interesting, you know, because if I have been on a run of interviews or working a lot, and then I take a little break with all the yoga I do, I detox. And what I'm detoxing for is the caffeine or the guarana or the taurine or all these, you know, more recently discovered stimulants. And I wish I'd known about it earlier. It would have saved me a lot of money.
In your book, you quote Oscar Wilde as having said,
yes,
"Beauty is the wonder of wonders. It is only the shallow people who do not judge by appearances." Do you think of yourself as beautiful?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Although I think I was lucky that I looked a certain way and in the wake of certain characters who come out of the music business, who, let's face it, if by any traditional standards, a Bob Dylan, a Keith Richards, a Mick Jagger would not be regarded as either necessarily good-looking or even sexy. Certainly in the 40s, you couldn't have given them the way. By the time I came along, in the wake of people like that, I had an appeal because I had a bit of an echo of these characters who'd been some way established in the hip sensibility of my generation as being attractive. So I traded off that. I don't think, so I just got lucky. And that's been, I have been a lucky boy in many ways, but then I've also been chastised well. So, and that was my near-death experience when I, because I was on the brink apparently. So I did go to the edge, but it was not a drug overdose. And certainly I was not deliberately self-destructive. I was just a constant experimenter who got caught up in my own mythology and, you know, and the con that comes with that.
Do you think of beauty now, having photographed so many really interesting rock stars, some of whom are just like born handsome or beautiful, and others who kind of created their image, do you think of beauty as something that is physiological or something that you can just kind of create through force of personality or through design?
I think it's a combination of those two things. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're 5 foot two, 300 pounds, well, no, bald isn't necessarily a bad thing today, but maybe, and you know, and it, maybe it's harder to project that. But I do think it's a combination of things. Debbie Harry is beautiful as far as I'm concerned. She will tell you that she didn't particularly like the way, and she writes about it in the foreword to the book, she didn't particularly care for the way she looked when she was younger. And certainly she became more and more obviously beautiful. One of the things she did, of course, was to start dyeing her hair. And that really helped her. But it was obviously always there because look at the bone structure. But as her attitude evolved, I think she became what she became, which is absolutely unequivocally, just the greatest blonde that ever rocked, as I call her. So I do think there's loads of pretty people out there, but are pretty people necessarily beautiful? You know, no, not necessarily. They are pretty. Now, you can be pretty and beautiful. You can also be kind of off-center and beautiful. I mean, look at, again, take Keith Richards and Keith just looks interesting nowadays, but you look back to him, you know, around the time of Altamont and that period. I mean, now you look at him, you go, wow, look at that. He kind of defined the beauty of the rock and roll look. Was Elvis beautiful? I think, yeah, Elvis was always beautiful, wasn't he? There was a moment in time when he was beyond beautiful. He was completely fabulous. I think as the mythology accretes around certain people, something happens to their sensibility, but something happens in the way people view them. You can, if you like, impose. I mean, she's not really that good looking, and if you see her in the flesh, you wouldn't take a lot of notice of her. But Madonna's someone who worked very hard at that. I don't think, because I remember meeting her before she was known at all, and frankly, she was plain, you know, but she learnt a lot of tricks. In fact, you just go back to someone like Marlene Dietrich or even Greta Garbo. You look at stuff of stills taken from early Greta Garbo pictures in the 20s in Sweden, or early films of Marlene Dietrich, even The Blue Angel, which was the one that put her on the map. They were neither of them particularly attractive women. So they learned little tricks of makeup, and certainly Dietrich learned about lighting. And as their sense of themselves grew, so, and their understanding of little tricks of makeup, of lighting, all this stuff, so they became much better looking. There is a word, photogenic, as well. Some people in the flesh look fabulous, and it's very difficult to get them on film. Some people in the flesh look you know, fairly regularly. You get them on film and they're like magic. Some people look great in person and photograph like a dream. So, you know, it does depend on the individual.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Listen, I had a lot of fun. You've been a lot of fun to talk to.
Mick Rock, his new book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie. It's called Picture This.